The question is often asked, is the Bhagavad Gita a book of action? Does it promote violence? People, Westerners, or even Indians who get influenced by Western thought often think that here is this Arjuna, he doesn't want to fight because he doesn't want to destroy his near and dear ones, and Krishna the Lord is telling him, get up and fight. And that criticism is leveled against even the Ramayana. Okay, what is the story of Ramayana? Ram went to Lanka, destroyed Ravana. And so many of our gods and goddesses have weapons. So is Hinduism a religion of violence? That is often brought as a criticism. But the main tenet of Vedanta or Hinduism is Ahimsa Paramo Dharma. The supreme dharma, the supreme goodness, supreme good for the society is non-violence, ahimsa. Ahimsa is the supreme good. And in fact, if you look at the history of India, especially the Hindus have never attacked any other country. We have never conquered any country. We have never attacked. We have never tried to take anybody's land, anybody's territory. In fact, India has always been attacked by foreigners, by Muslims, by Christians, you know, the Mughals, the British, the Portuguese, the French. And they came and captured our country and ruled over us for hundreds of years. In my opinion, the reason for that is the misunderstanding of our religion, where people think ahimsa is the highest, so I should not fight. And it almost becomes to the point of cowardice. And Hindus and Indians traditionally have been very divided, you know, one region with another, my state and your state, my language, your language, my kingdom, your kingdom, my caste, your caste. And so we have always been divided, and that has been our downfall. So Arjuna is doing the same thing, this pacifism that, oh, the Kauravas, even though they are bad, even though they have done this, even though they have done that, even though they poisoned us, even though they tried to burn us, even though they stole our land, even though they insulted our women, but I should not fight because fighting is wrong. I should not kill them, even though these people are felons. And later on, you will see in the first verse, he says, I'll rather sit down on the floor without weapons and have them cut my head rather than fight. So this pacifism, that when there is evil in front of you, or when you are being attacked by somebody who has wrong intentions, it is your duty to resist. And that is what Krishna is teaching him, that it is our duty. And Arjuna, being a warrior, being the leader of the Pandavas, and without him, the war would have never been won. And he's acting like that. So that is the message of the Bhagavad Gita, that when there is something wrong happening, when there is evil happening, it is our duty to resist. It is our duty to fight back. And that's what Gandhiji also did in his struggle for independence. And that is what the message of the Bhagavad Gita is. Gandhiji, of course, used to read the Bhagavad Gita every day, and the Ishavasya Upanishad. Those were his two favorite texts. So far in the first chapter, we talk about Arjuna's grief, Arjuna Vishad Yoga. We see that why Arjuna was behaving the way he was, what was his thinking, and also the first chapter connects us with the entire Mahabharata story. So there is the description of the war. That's why the first chapter people think it's not very important. But there are a lot of beautiful messages we can get from it, which we shall try to cover. So in the first six verses that we did last week, Duryodhana, the king of the evil Kauravas, or the oldest brother, approaches his guru and tells him, Guru, look at this mighty army of the Pandavas. And he names all the great warriors, and they are all standing here. What it shows is his own fear, his own weakness, that he's afraid, and so he's trying to talk his way out of the fear. But the language he uses for his guru is very insulting, and we shall see that in the seventh verse. So we'll continue the story. And at the same time, the blind king Dhritarashtra is sitting in his palace and his prime minister Sanjay is giving him this whole story, this whole information by remote vision, what we call as Divya Drishti, he could see. So verse number 7. Asmakam tu vishishtaye,
asmakam tu vishishtaye,
tani bodhadvijottama,
tani bodhadvijottama,
nayakamam sainyasya,
nayakamam sainyasya,
sanyartham tan bravimite,
sanyartham tan bravimite.
Asmakam tu vishishta, ours also, asmakam, ours also vishishta, there are lot of great people in our army. Tan nibodha, oh look at them, dvijotama, he calls Drona twice born, because a brahmana is called twice born, so we'll talk about that, what do they mean by twice born. So he calls him twice born, he says look nibodha. Now Drona is, you know, a great general. He has taught Duryodhana everything he knew. And to tell him, look at the army and point it out, because he has, in one glance, he has already studied everything. For him, you know, he doesn't, it's like, you know, a high school student, you know, who has studied math from his math teacher, and then there is a problem. He said, look, this is how you solve it. How foolish will that be? That's how Duryodhana is acting, telling him, look. And he says, Vishishta, there are a lot of great Nayaka, there are a lot of great generals of my army also. And Sangyartham Tyan Tan Bravimite, and for your information, I'm telling you who are the generals in our army. Now he is the commander and he's telling him who are the generals in my army. See, that is another, his attitude, that everything is mine. I am the king and they are all here for me. And so this I and my is there very strong in Duryodhana. So the word, so there is one concept in Sanskrit, there is a word called Sinhavalokan. Sinhavalokan means watching like a lion. It's a very interesting phrase. So if, I mean, of course we haven't seen lions, but if you have seen movies or it is what they say is that a lion doesn't walk rapidly through the forest. What he does is he will walk a short distance slowly, majestically. He will stop and he will look around. You know, is everything okay? You know, show that I am the boss. And is everybody behaving and everything is fine? Or is there any danger or is there any prey? Then again, he'll walk a few steps and again he'll stop. So the point of this is that the spiritual studies should also be done like that. We don't read a Gita like a novel. Okay, pat, okay, ho gaya. You know, I finished Bhagavad Gita. You know, 2 weeks I read the whole 18. You can't do that. That is not the way to read a spiritual text. What one has to do is read, and then after a few pages, or after half a chapter, go back and recapitulate. What have I studied? So see the situation. What have I studied? And then move on. Then only the knowledge will stay with you. If you read it one time, it doesn't. Same thing, listening one time, you know, really doesn't have that much impact. I myself, when I listen, I don't remember that much. You remember a little bit. But it's very important to go back and recapitulate. What is it that we heard today? Or what is it that we discussed? What are the verses we covered? So either before coming to the class or after going to the class in the evening, it's a good idea too. That's why I would encourage everybody to have the Bhagavad Gita. If anybody doesn't have, they should buy it, because then only then you can follow what we are discussing in the class, because we are using Swami Chinmayananda's Gita as our basis for this discussion. So that is called Sinhavalokan, not only in our spiritual studies, but they say also in life. One should do that. What is my goal in life? Of course, we have financial goals, we have family goals, we have personal goals, you know, my exercise, my diet, my, you know, whatever, you know, how I'm going to increase my retirement and all that. So, and that we do, you know, periodically we meet with our financial advisor, you know, once a year or every 6 months. Let's see how the, you know, funds are doing. Are they growing? Are they not? If not, how can we, you know, change it? But the same thing has to be done in my spiritual pursuit, that what is my goal in spirituality? And my goal is knowing myself, knowing God, realizing God, becoming one with that. And that has to be the goal of every human being, especially those who are coming to this class. We have to make that our goal. And periodically one has to recapitulate and look back. Okay, in this past month, how much have I done for my spiritual growth? How much knowledge have I acquired? How much have I progressed? Am I closer to God now than I was last month or 6 months ago or last year? So in the beginning of the year and the beginning of every month, or even maybe every week on Sunday, you know, recapitulate that. What have I done? Have I done something to make the world better? Have I served the people? Have I studied? Is my knowledge clearer? So that is called Sinhavalokan. That's why, you know, we periodically try to recapitulate. Like today we covered the first 6 verses. So that should be the way study should be done. Now we see that the words Duryodhan uses is Dvijotama. He calls him a twice born. He calls him a Brahmin. Now Dronacharya was born a Brahmin, but he had great interest in warfare, and he was the one of the greatest warriors of his time. Probably only Bhishma was better than him. He was probably the, you know, the top, the best, one of the best warriors on both sides. Maybe Arjuna, maybe close to him, but that's about it. And so he had not only had interest in the warfare, but he had taught the warfare to the Pandavas and the Kauravas. So to your guru, he's using insulting words like Brahmin, you know, twice born. Brahmin, when you tell him, that means you are a Brahmin, you don't belong here. Why are you even here? You know, so, I mean, to use, because as we saw in the first, last week I mentioned, he first insulted him by saying, look, all the people standing in front of us are your students. You are the one who taught them. And that's why we are in this problem. Arjuna and Drishtadyumna and all of them. And now he's calling him a Brahmin. That, I don't think, you know, he's the commander of his forces. He is his guru, his teacher. To use such words is highly insulting, because in our tradition, guru is like God. You know, Guru Paduka Stotram, I am currently studying. So he says that, Namo Namashri Guru Paduka Abhyam. He says, I prostrate to the feet of my guru. I prostrate. So the idea is that I was ignorant. Jadyabdi Samsho Shanavarayabhyam. So he says, I was drowning in this ocean of ignorance. The ocean, Abdi means ocean. And you are the heat, Guru. Your words are the heat that have burnt this water and dried it and got me out of it. So that kind of attitude one should have. And I prostrate to you again and again. And to use such words for his teacher is highly insulting and highly inappropriate. But at that time, Duryodhana, A, he was afraid. B, that was his nature. He really didn't care for how he treated people. That was his problem throughout his life. And that's why he says, to inform you, I am telling you, which is a very foolish statement to say to the one of the greatest generals of that time, that I'm telling you what are the soldiers on my side and what are the soldiers on their side. So then he, 8th verse, Bhavan Bhishmascha Karnascha.
Bhavan Bhishmascha Karnascha.
Kripascha Samitinjayaha.
Kripascha Samitinjayaha.
Ashvatthama Vikarnascha.
Ashvatthama Vikarnascha.
Saumadattisthathaivacha.
Saumadattisthathaivacha.
So now, Duryodhan, he was not a fool. He was very smart. And he realized that kuch jyada ho gaya. You know, I've spoken too much now. I think I made a mistake. Because after all, he's the commander. He's my leader. And I am insulting him. And that's not good. And on top of that, Drona, for these 5-6 verses, didn't speak a word. Was totally silent. And Duryodhana suddenly realizes, something I have said wrong. So then it's called na makkhan lagana. Now he's trying to butter him up so that he shouldn't get angry, because he can see in his face that Drona is not happy. You know? So then he suddenly changes his tone. See, first he had called him tu, you know, in the previous verse. Now he calls him Bhavan. Bhavan means up, like in Sanskrit, like in Hindi. You know, when we to our friend, we say tu, but our father or our guru, we say up, like in Spanish, we say usted. So same way, he tells him Bhavan. So he suddenly changes his tone, not because he has developed more respect for Drona, but it is his strategic, because he's cunning. And, you know, these people know how to use others. He says, Bhavan, now who are the great soldiers on our side? He says, Bhavan, you, sir, you were number one. Then Bhishma. Now Bhishma was the overall commander. And the way it was Bhishma was the overall commander and commander of the defense. And Dronacharya was commander of the offensive forces. But he still mentions Drona before Bhishma, even though Bhishma was a greater warrior, just so that he shouldn't get his feelings hurt. He says, Bhavan, you, sir, Bhishma, and then Karna. Karna, of course, we all know, was a great warrior, was actually the older brother of the Pandavas, but was fighting on the wrong side. And Kripa. Kripacharya was Dronacharya's brother-in-law. And Samitinjaya, and he has never lost, one of the great warriors, victorious. Kripa the victorious. And Ashwatthama, your son, Vikarna. Vikarna was one of Duryodhana's brother, Saumadatti. So the son of Saumadatti, and Tathaivacha, and all the others. So it's interesting, he names seven warriors. Drona, Bhishma, Karna, Kripa, Ashwatthama, Vikarna, and Saumadatti. Out of seven, three are related to Dronacharya, because he's trying to make him, you know, wake up to him. So one is Drona himself, then Kripa, his brother-in-law, and Ashwatthama, his son. So there are so many other greater warriors, but he doesn't mention them because he's very cunningly trying to make up to Dronacharya. And he, in fact, doesn't even mention his own son, but he mentions Drona's son. So the idea is that he is praising him because he's worried about failure. Because failure, you know, that when one is not sure about our success, then what happens is person gets worried. And the more worried, the more he talks. He keeps on talking again and again. Everything will be all right. Will everything be all right? You know, he goes around asking. So that's what Duryodhana is doing. Talking about failure reminds me of a little story. It's in Hindi, so those who don't understand, I'll repeat in English, but it's more fun in Hindi. So, baap apne bete se poochta hai, tere imtihan mein kya hua, tu pass hua ke nahi, exam mein tu pass hua ke nahi. To beta bolta hai, headmaster ka beta fail ho gaya. He says, main headmaster ke liye nahi, tere liye pooch raha hu. Sarpanch ka beta fail ho gaya, you know, gaon ka sarpanch ka beta fail ho gaya. Said, nahi nahi, tera kya hua? Pujari hai mandir ka, uska beta bhi fail ho gaya. So he says, main unke liye nahi puch raha hu, tere liye puch raha hu. Kehta hai, un sab ke bete fail ho gaye, tu kya pradhan mantri hai? So I'll translate it. He says that the father asked the son, how was your exam result? So the son says, you know, the school principal, his son failed. And then the mayor of the town, his son failed. And even the temple priest, his son failed. So he says, I'm not asking about all of them. I'm asking about you. He says, if all their children failed, do you think you are Prime Minister of India? So he was worried about his failure. And so that's why he uses such language. And that's why he keeps on. He had lack of confidence. He was afraid. He was stressed out. So all this we see, and he keeps on talking. And we'll do verse number 9, and then maybe, you know, take a short break if somebody has any questions. Anye cha bahava shuraha.
Anye cha bahava shuraha.
Madarthe tyak. Jivitaha.
Madarte tyakta jivitaha. नाना शस्त्र प्रहरणाः
सर्वे युद्ध विशारदाः So now what he does, he realizes that he has only mentioned seven warriors, while in the Pandava case in the last week we saw he had three verses of listing all the warriors, including Arjuna's son and Draupadi's children. And he says, you know, we have so many, so I have forgotten them. You know, and at that time his mind was so, he wasn't even thinking, you know, who are my, he only mentioned those who were around him. He said, Anye, and there are many other Bahava Shuraha, there are other great warriors in our army, and they are here, why? Madarthe, for me. Tyakta Jivitaha, they are ready to give up their life for me. See, that is his arrogance, his pride, his ego speaking. And Nana Shastra Praharanaha, and they are all endowed with very powerful weapons. All these warriors, as we know in those days, the warriors did have a lot of weapons. They actually had missiles that, you know, would cause fire. Then they could shoot one arrow which would split into multiple arrows. And they were like, which would go and explode, you know, almost like grenades. And so all these weapons they had, besides the, you know, so even the individual warriors, their arrows had a lot more capabilities, you know. So he says, Nana Shastra Praharnaha. Sarve Yuddha Visharadaha, and all of them, Visharad means very accomplished. So these are all very accomplished in warfare. Now you look at the difference between Duryodhana and Arjuna. Duryodhana is speaking with pure ego. You know, it's my army, my soldiers, my generals, all of them have come to give their life up for me. You know, actually a lot of them had not. Some of them had come because Hastinapur was a powerful kingdom. Lot of them had come for Bhishma, because Bhishma was such a respected and powerful great warrior that when he calls, you know, it's like a person who is you know, is very prominent in the city, and he picks up the phone and calls somebody, look, I need your help. I want you to join this community service. He cannot say no, because so same way when Bhishma calls, you know, people come. So for Duryodhana to think that this is my war and they are here for me and they are here for my, you know, to give up their lives for me is ego. While Arjuna, as we will see later in the first chapter, never says, he says, I am fighting for the Pandavas, this war we are fighting. And even while he's fighting, he doesn't say, I'm fighting for myself. He says, I'm fighting for all of them, for the kingdom. And he, even when he's fighting, he's still concerned about the opposition, that what will happen to them, and also for the whole country, that there's such a big war, there will be so much destruction, so many men will be killed, the women will become widows, the children will become orphans, as we will see in the later on in the first chapter, how much damage. So even while he's fighting, he's still concerned about the other side. He's concerned about the total effect of the war, how much problems it will cause. While Duryodhana, all he's thinking about is me, my, and I. And that is the difference between a person with ego and a person who is fighting for a higher cause. Even though Arjuna at times gets deluded, but inside he was a very noble, very, very giving individual. And that's why in the fifth chapter, Bhagavan Krishna says, Brahman yadhaya karmani sangam tyaktva karoti yaha lipyate nasa papena padma patram ivam vasa. So he says, Brahmani yadhaya karmani. So one who does his or her duties dedicated to Lord, Brahmani Adhaya, keeping Lord as his support, Sangam Tyaktva, without attachment and without I and my, I'm doing the Lord's work, it's not me, he is working through me. One who does such activity, even if he has to kill the enemy, if he's not doing it as me, if he's dedicating it to the Lord, doing God's work, it is necessary for society, Lipyate Nasa Papena, for him there is no sin. There is no papa, He is never contaminated, just as Padma Patram Ivambasa, just as a lotus leaf, even though it lives in the water, but the moment you put water on it, it slides off, because the lotus leaf has an oily substance on the surface. So water drops never stay on the lotus leaf. So similarly, a person who is acting in the world unselfishly, dedicating his activities to Lord without I and my, not for my benefit, but what is good for society, then such a person, even it may appear that the deeds are wrong, he is not contaminated by sin. So that is the difference between Duryodhana and Arjuna in this instance, and we can see that how Duryodhana's actions are. Any questions, any comments? No, he knew what he was doing was wrong, but he was so compelled by his vastness. See, he was not a fool. He knew that all along he has been doing. That's why when a person is, say, stealing, they don't do it in open air. They do it quietly, you know. They steal when at the middle of the night or when the person. So when a person is doing wrong, he or she knows they're doing wrong, but they are compelled by their vasanas, by their desires, by their selfishness, by their ego, and by his greed for more power and for more kingdom. And jealousy. So all those things, his greed, his jealousy, his selfishness, his, you know, cunning, desires, all that. So all those factors were in play in him at one time.
Bhishma knew that they are going to lose this war.
Yes.
Way ahead of time. Yet he calls all his friends or whatever it is to come to the war. Only to invite the death for them.
No. See, his idea was he had taken a pledge to serve Hastinapur. So,
at any cost,
he said, I'm going to do what is good for Hastinapur. I'm going to do what I can do best for Hastinapur to win. And that was his pledge, you know, which he had. So this was part of that I'm going to fight with my full effort, and I'm whatever effort it takes to, so that Hastinapur, the throne, should be. He was actually, his pledge he had taken, but he had also misunderstood. See, that's the thing, you know, in those days there was chivalry was there. You keep your word, but then they used to keep their word even to the point of doing wrong. And that's what...
That is the part, you know, then
yes.
Bhishma, knowing such an intelligent person.
Right.
Yeah, he subscribed to the evil.
Absolutely, yes. Even Dronacharya. But also they had lived in the throne. They had lived in the palace of Duryodhana. See, Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra was the king. So Duryodhana says, you have eaten my salt, you know, namakaya. I have fed you for so many years, now it is your duty to fight for me. Even though they didn't want to. A lot of the warriors, soldiers were not. And Duryodhana knew that. See, if you are evil and if you are on the wrong side, then your troops won't be motivated to fight. They are only fighting because they are being paid or they are being convinced. While on the Pandava side, they knew that they have the good on with them, you know, the goodness. That's why Satyamev Jayate. So the person who is on the wrong is always worried and always very suspicious, always questioning. But that's a good point.
So in this war, is there somewhere that Pandava is also responsible for this war?
No, I don't think so, because they didn't have a choice. See, from childhood, the Kauravas had stolen, had tried to poison them, had tried to burn them. Then when the kingdom was divided in half, they stole it by, you know, illegal means, by gambling. Then they insulted their wife, Draupadi, you know, tried to take off her clothes, you know that story. And then the Pandavas went into the forest for 12 years. That was the condition of losing. And then they said, after 12 years, you have to be hidden for 1 year. And they did. And after 13 years, you will get half your kingdom back. So they came. And he refused to give the kingdom back, even though they had fulfilled all the conditions. Then even Yudhishthir even said, I told you last week, I'm ready to take 5 villages. I don't even want the kingdom. I'm even ready to take 5 houses, one for each brother. And Duryodhana said, I won't even give as much land on the tip of a needle. And even Krishna went to negotiate and ask for peace. And he totally, so they had no choice. So I think when you're faced with evil, who is not also for the benefit of the country, It was important to remove. That's what Krishna's motive was, that I have to remove this evil. Otherwise, it is bad for the country, for the future of the country. It's like if the ruler of the country is corrupt or dishonest, or, you know, then the country doesn't do well. So I don't think the Pandavas had any fault at all. They were actually compelled to fight. They had no other choice.
Do they also think that on some level they can get away with it? Is that why they keep going? I mean, if you look from a cosmic point of view, you pay for what you do, good or bad. So if on some level they know what they are doing is wrong, so they also don't believe in ultimate justice. They think they can get away. They only see the short-term view. How does it
mean? I think when a person is doing wrong, at that time he is so blinded that he doesn't think of what are the long-term consequences. He is looking at the current, okay, what is good for me tomorrow, not what will happen in later. And you say, who has seen, you know, karma, this after a few years or next life, who has seen all that? So people at that moment, their vision is very clouded, I think.
In history, you see that a lot of times people say they're doing things for the Lord, for God, like the crusades and all these things. Even if they're doing horrible things, do you still say that they're doing them without sin?
No, I think horrible things, no, they're not justified. If you're doing, the Pandavas, it's like I said, not defense. Like India was always attacked and we never defended ourselves. And so we were under foreign rule for several hundred years. So submitting to evil is wrong. But if you go out of your way to capture others' land and kill them, just by using God's name doesn't make you right. Your actions have to be right. It's the motive and also the actions. So I think Pandavas were fighting a defensive war where they were being persecuted. While if you use God's name and then go out and kill others and take over their land and forcibly convert them, I don't think in the cosmic vision, you may think you're doing the right thing, but I don't think God will be pleased with that. That's my belief. I may be wrong.
So does it matter who your enemy is? Because, you know, you say Gandhiji read the Gita every day, but he preached ahimsa against the British. He was not happy with any Indian leader who took up arms or Subhash Chandra Bose and people like that.
Right.
Whereas Krishna instructs Arjuna to pick up the arms and go to war. So does it matter who the enemy is then?
I think it's the situation. Whatever the situation was, because Gandhiji had seen that, like in the 1857 war, when, you know, Indians picked up weapons, Rani Ki Jhansi and all, and they lost and they were very badly. And also, the Indians were not united in willingness to fight, because half of them were serving the British, half of them were not. And I think it would have created a lot of conflict, a lot of violence, you know, throughout the country. And for him, because his idea was non-violence is the method to choose, while Krishna's situation was different, because I don't think Duryodhana would have listened to ahimsa or non-violence. So I think it depends on the situation. Arjuna was a warrior, he was a warrior. So he had to, and he had to let him do his duty, what he was trained for. I think each situation is different.
The enemy also depends on your enemy.
Yeah,
that's what the Britishers were, different kind of enemies considering the Kauravas.
Yeah.
They're different kind of enemies. They
yes.
were not the enemies which can be made to understand and things like that. But Kaurava was totally blind to the righteousness.
Right.
So only way you can, it's like a Ravana. Ravana was given all the chances to survive and pick it up.
Right.
It's the same way the Kaurava.
True.
There is no other way but eliminate. It's like your cancer in the foot. When you treat them, as long as you can treat it, then you have to cut the thing off.
Absolutely.
I think this evil doers, I'm not going to say one person or other, are the cancer to the society sometimes.
Right.
So you have to somehow either treat it with something or eliminate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
But even the Gandhiji stage, there was no choice. I have to analyze the situation. because the country was so divided, they couldn't even make an ornament of them.
Exactly.
So the best of our weapon is nonviolence.
Nonviolence, yes. Thank you. Yeah.
Then one more thing, at least my observation, that the difference between Mahatma Gandhi and Arjuna, I think both were trying to fight war against the evil. But I think Arjuna was a warrior by nature. Gandhiji, so you have to go with what your nature is.
Yes.
And use that to fight the war. And I think Gandhiji is the Swadharma. So to me, that is
true. Also one of the true, yeah.
But would it have made a difference if we were ruled by the Germans, by say Hitler's army or something?
Probably we would have had to fight.
Then we would have had to
fight. Yeah, I don't. Because they would have just killed. They would have just slaughtered everybody.
There was no unity among us.
Right.
That is what Gandhiji could not do anything. Whether it's the Germans or the Portuguese or the French, it would have been the same situation. We were not united. Everybody was separate pockets of kings.
But he was still able to unite enough to bring on the Swaraj movement. So I'm
but
sure
every time he was doing, what is the peace talk and everything somewhere else, then they would burn up the places and everything. So it was very difficult for him.
That's because he was promoting Ahimsa. Yeah. He wanted to do something more.
But in this case, what I'm saying is the circumstance. Arjuna, first of all, was a warrior. Second of all, in those days, that's the only solution they had. There was no negotiations at all left. Because they had already done.
They had already tried, yes. Right? Krishna had already done. Thank you. We'll move on. Verse number 10. Aparyaptam tadasmakam.
Aparyaptam tadasmakam.
Balam bhishma bhirakshitam.
Balam bhishma bhirakshitam.
Paryaptam tvidametesham.
Paryaptam tvidametesham.
Balam bhima bhirakshitam.
Balam bhima bhirakshitam.
So the word aparyaptam has actually two meanings. That's the beauty of Sanskrit, that depending on the context, you can interpret it in two ways. So one meaning is unlimited and one meaning is insufficient. Two different, insufficient or inadequate. So aparyaptam tadasmakam. So our army, here he says balam, our army. Balam is army. Balam is not power. Here balam is army. Our army, bhishma abhirakshitam, protected by bhishma. As we said, like in football also, we have the offensive line, and then we have the quarterback and the running back and the receiver. So when we have to move the ball, then the offensive unit comes, and then the quarterback throws the ball or runs. But when your other team has the ball, then you have the defensive linemen, who are blocking, who are not letting the guy run or not letting him catch. So similarly, in the army, they had an offensive unit and a defensive unit. So here, he's talking, Rakshita means the defensive unit. So our army, the defensive unit, is headed by Bhishma. Bhishma, as we know, was a great warrior and had a great pledge. If we have time, we'll talk about it. So Bhishma Abhirakshitam. So the army that is protected by Bhishma is ours, and Paryaptam and limited or sufficient, depending how you want to interpret, to idam etesham. So this army, balam bhima abhirakshitam. So the Pandavas, even though their overall commander was Trishtadyumna, he was the commander of the offensive unit, and Bhima commanded the defensive unit. So he says, our army is headed by Bhishma, and their army is headed by Bhima. Now, one meaning is that our army is unlimited and their army is limited. And why did he say that? Because they had more soldiers. They had 11 regiments as opposed to 7 regiments for the Pandavas. And we shouldn't forget, Krishna had given his entire army to them. Yeah. See, the entire, so that shifted such a balance, because so many thousands of soldiers, all well equipped with a lot of weapons and everything, was given to them And Krishna said, I'll be on one side without any weapons. I won't pick up any weapons. So you can have either my whole army with all their equipment, or you can have me without weapons. And Arjuna says, I want you, Lord. And Duryodhan thinks, Krishna, what use is he? Without weapons, he's nothing. And that was his thinking throughout. If you look at it, nowhere he mentions Krishna. He thinks Krishna without weapons is useless. But if you look at it, Krishna was the one that directed the whole war. The entire outcome of the war, the Pandavas winning, was Krishna's doing. It's like in football or in basketball. In football especially, there's the coach. Now the coach decides, you know, what plays are we going to play, what players are going to play, are we going to throw the ball, run the ball. He knows the defense, he knows, you know, what position, are we near the goal line, are we far away. So all those situations, so the coach is the one very important in directing how the team does, even though the quarterback gets the glory or the running back gets all the praise, but it is the coach. So similarly here, Krishna didn't want any glory for himself. Nowhere he says Arjuna is the one who won the war. He you know, projects him as the commander, as the leader, but behind the scenes, constantly he is administering and deciding what should be done. So here he says that their army is very limited. He could see that. And my army is unlimited. As far as I can see, my soldiers are there. Why? Because he had a lot more soldiers. But another meaning is our army is insufficient and their army is sufficient. Even though their army is less, but and our army is more, but inside he had a fear that maybe I'm not strong enough to handle this conflict. And my army at the end, because he also knew that a lot of the generals and kings had come because of Bhishma, not because of me. And so if something happens to Bhishma, they will run away. So he was insecure. And so one meaning is mine is unlimited and theirs is limited. Or he says mine is insufficient and theirs is sufficient. So that's all. There is not much. Then suddenly now he decides that I have to give command. You know, he's coming out of his confusion and agitation and worry and all. And suddenly he says, you know, I need to give some orders to my army. So in the verse number 11, Ayaneshu cha sarveshu.
Ayaneshu cha sarveshu.
Yatha bhagam avasthitaha.
Yatha bhagam avasthitaha.
Bhishma meva bhirakshantu.
Bhishma meva bhirakshantu.
Bhavantah sarva evahi.
Bhavantah sarva evahi.
So now he uses the imperative mode, like giving an order, like do it. You know, like the one is that please, can you please do it? And finally they don't listen, say, look, I'm telling you, you have to do this. You know, like your employee or your child doesn't listen. So here now he's using the imperative tone. Rakshantu. Rakshantu means do it. It's a command. So Ayaneshu cha sarveshu. So all of these soldiers, all of these regiments, all of these different divisions, all of them, yatha bhagam avasthitaha, wherever you are stationed, because the way they used to organize the army, they would be in particular formation. Like they were in an eagle formation where there was the middle and then there were the two flanks, you know, to outflank the enemy. So he says, whatever position all of you are stationed, all soldiers, all commanders, what do you have to do? Bhishmam. Bhishma eva abhirakshantu. Your main job is to protect Bhishma. Bhavanta, you all, sarva evahi, all of you. Now, why does he want to protect Bhishma? Because, as we said, Bhishma was the greatest warrior, the greatest general, the most, you know, powerful presence on the Kaurava side. And another commentary I was reading, that Duryodhana, because being dishonest, he never trusted anybody. You know, a person who himself is a crook will never trust anybody else because he's always suspicious, because he thinks with his own brain. So he thought, even though Bhishma is fighting on my side, I don't trust him because he has a soft corner for the Pandavas. Same thing for Drona, he was very suspicious. He said, I don't trust these two. even though they are on my side, they might switch any moment. And in fact, one time during the war, he actually goes and verbally, you know, shouts at Bhishma that you are not doing enough because you love the Pandavas more than me. And same thing he was telling Dronacharya. So the reason he said protect Bhishma, also he meant keep an eye on him, make sure that he's doing what he's supposed to do. So that's why, and also as I mentioned, a lot of the kings had come because of Bhishma. So he felt that if Bhishma falls, and so we should protect him so that my whole army will be maintained. So this is all he says, that let us protect Bhishma. Then we'll go to verse number 12. Tasya Sanjanayan Harsham.
Tasya Sanjanayan Harsham.
Guru Vriddha Pitamaha.
Guru Vriddha Pitamaha.
Simhanadam Vinadyau Chaihi.
Simhanadam Vinadyau Chaihi.
Shankham Dadmau Pratapavan.
Shankham Dadmau Pratapavan.
So now what happened is Bhishma is watching. You know, he's close by and he's watching and listening to this conversation between Duryodhana and Dronacharya. And he realizes that Duryodhana is just babbling and rambling, not making any sense. One sentence is not connected. And what it's going to do is dishearten the troops. Because if your leader is confused and doesn't know what to do, what are the troops going to do? So he felt that I need to stop this conversation, which is getting nowhere. You know, he's just mumbling different things at different times. You protect this, you do that, you, without any sense. So he says, I need to put a stop to this conversation and I need to improve the morale of my forces, of my troops. So, tasya sanjanayan harsham. So, to increase the joy, increase the enthusiasm of his troops, Guru Vriddha Pitamaha. Pitamaha means he was the grandsire, he was the grandfather, and he was the most senior. There was his uncle was the one who was senior, older than him. But among the active, you know, leaders, Pitamaha, Bhishma was the oldest. So that's why he says Guru Vriddha, the oldest among the gurus, Pitamaha. What did he do? Simha Nadam Vinadhi Auchaihi, loudly. He let out a lion's roar like that. And you know, he was so much power, his sound reverberated through the entire, you know, whole ground. That much, that loudly he spoke, like a lion's roar, you know, to encourage him. And Shankham Dadmau Pratapavan, and his Shankha is the conch, Dadmau, he blew the conch powerfully, Pratapavan. So what did he do? He wanted to increase the enthusiasm and the courage of his troops. So he loudly roared and he blew the conch. Now Bhishma, why was he called Bhishma? Everybody knows the story, or does everybody, or they would like to hear? I think most people would like to hear it. So Bhishma is a very, very interesting story. When he was a young man, his father was the king, Shantanu, of that kingdom. And he, Bhishma, of course, was the only son, and he was supposed to inherit the throne because he was the crown prince. And his father, Shantanu, one time was out hunting, and after that he was looking for some water. So he goes to a village and he sees a very beautiful girl, very pretty young girl. And as the kings were in those days, he takes a fancy to her, you know, that I have to marry her. And he's totally in love with that girl, just seeing her one time. And of course, kings had multiple wives, so that was no problem. So then he approaches the king, the girl's father, and says, I would like to marry your daughter. Now, the father was very smart, you know. He said, King, look, you want to marry my daughter, there's one condition. That her son will be the ruler. You have to promise me that you will make her son the king. Now, Shantanu loved Bhishma. You know, Bhishma was not only brave, but very, you know, very noble, very good character and all. So he couldn't promise, you know, this this father that I'm going to make your grandson the king, when my own son, who is older and more accomplished, so he comes back. But he's so depressed because now he wants to have, you know, it's like I have to have that girl. And so he looks depressed, he looks very unhappy, he's not eating and not doing anything, not taking any interest. So Bhishma says, something is wrong with my father. So he doesn't ask him directly, but he asks the soldiers who had, he says, since that hunting trip, he asks soldiers what happened. So he said, you know, that he saw that girl and he went and met the father and he wanted to marry her. So he said, Bhishma says, okay, let me go find out what. He doesn't say anything to his father. He goes to that girl and the fisherman and he says, so what is your condition? Why don't you want your daughter to marry my father? So she says, that's my condition, that, you know, her son will be the ruler, not you. So Bhishma said, no problem. I give you my word. And in those days, if they gave the word, there was no contract, no agreement. I give you my word. I won't go after the kingdom. Your grandson will have the kingdom. My word I give you. He says, okay, you are giving your word, but how about when you have sons of your own, you have children of your own, they will want the throne and they will then fight with my grandson. I don't trust that. I don't trust your word. I mean, you may decide you don't want it, but your children will fight. So Bhishma says, I take a pledge that I'm not going to marry and I'm not going to have any children. So a young man, he took a pledge of celibacy that I'm not going to have any children ever, not going to marry, so that my father's wish should be fulfilled, that he wants to marry that girl. That, you know, powerful pledge. So that much sacrifice he made for his father. That's why he was called Bhishma. Bhishma means the one who is very strong, very powerful. So that's why he was so much respected, because, you know, to do that for his father, that he sacrificed all his happiness so that my father should marry this girl, and then ultimately that girl's son becomes the king. And Bhishma says, I will spend my whole life protecting Hastinapur, the kingdom of Hastinapur, but I myself won't rule and I myself won't have any children. And so that's why he is very, very honored and respected. Among all the Mahabharata characters, if you read the Mahabharata story, the one who is the most honorable, one is Bhishma and one is Yudhishthir. These were the two people who always did the right thing. So that's why he blew the shankha. Now, shankha in Sanskrit has a very beautiful meaning. I was listening to commentary. So they said, shan means peace. Like the Shiva's name is Shankar, right? One of Shiva's name is Shankar. What does that mean? Shan karoti iti Shankar. So one, by chanting his name, you get peace. So that's why Shiva is called Shankar. By chanting his name, you get peace. But the shankh, why is it called shan? Shan means peace and kham means whole. Kham means space. That's why in Kaivalya Upanishad it says, kham vayur jyotir apaha prithvi vishvasya dharini. So the five elements are kham, vayu, jyoti, jala and prithvi. You know, the space, air, fire, water, earth. So kham means space. So shankh kham means peace in its space or peace in the whole. So the shankh itself has a lot of peace associated with it, because when it is chanted, blown, especially in the temple, if you look in, and the shankh blows with such, you know, sound, and then when it goes into silence, it becomes very peaceful, the atmosphere. That's why in the temple they always, you know, blow the conch, the shankh. So that's why shankh means that by blowing which, it creates peace in its whole, in its space. But here, of course, the shankha is not used for creating peace. Here it is used to declare war. And Bhishma, since he blew the first conch, it is like shooting the first bullet. You know, like when there are two armies and the person who shoots the first bullet or throws the first bomb or throws the first arrow is the aggressor. So here, when Bhishma blew the conch first, then he became the aggressor. So the Kauravas became the aggressor because they are the ones, it is said, who gave the first blow in the war. So that's what it's meant. He blew the conch. We'll do a couple more and then maybe stop for a minute. Or we can do 13 and then take a break, because the 14 has more commentary. So 13th will do. Tata shankhascha bhairyascha.
Tata shankhascha bhairyascha.
Panavanaka gomukhaha.
Panavanaka gomukhaha.
Sahasaivabhya hanyanta.
Sahasaivabhya hanyanta.
Sashabdastu mulo bhavat.
Sashabdastu mulo bhavat.
So then what happened? Once Bhishma blew his conch, then it became a signal for the entire Kaurava army. Okay, we need to join. Let us get going. Like, they are all waiting. Like, you know, there are a lot of cars waiting at a red light, and the light has been red for a long time. And there's a, you know, line backing up. And suddenly when the light turns green, everybody starts. So similarly, the green light was given by Bhishma. Okay, let's begin the war. And everybody then started making the all the instruments of noise were used. Shankha, you know, then all the conches were blown. Bhairya is like the kettle drums, these big drums, you know, no. You know, in the beginning of the war, to inspire the, you know, same way in even in football and all, you know, they you know, there's loud noise coming, you know, defense. Or in sports, you know, the team that, you know, makes the most noise, there's like two teams and there are fans on both sides. The fans that make the most noise inspire their team. Come on. So here also, all their, they had these band people, you know, who were carrying drums and trumpets and cow horns. And so all those things started. Panavanaka gomukhaha. So different kinds of drums and tebor. Tebor is a small drum and big cow horns, so all kind of noise making instruments were sahasa, and all of them abhihanyanta, and all of them started making noise together. Sabdas tumulo abhavata, big sound was created because all these noise making instruments were started. That's what here Sanjay, of course, we shouldn't forget, he's telling Dhritarashtra in the palace that this is what is happening on the battlefield. So when one starts, they all joined. And so that was the big noise created so far by the Kaurava army. Pandavas haven't replied. That will be next. Any other questions? Anything? Or can we move on? Okay, the next verse is important. It's a very good verse. Has a lot of discussion and meaning in it. Tata shvaitairhayer yukte.
Tata shvaitairhayer yukte.
Mahati syandane sthitau.
Mahati syandane sthitau.
Madhava pandavaschaiva.
Madhava pandavaschaiva.
Divyau shankhau pradatmatuhu.
Divyau shankhau pradatmatuhu.
So now comes the hero. See, like in the movie, you know, after the everything is built, and then the hero shows up with all the noise, and you know, when the hero and or heroine is coming, or like even in a stage show, first they have the beginning, and then finally when the main star is coming, you know, a main performer, then the whole, you know, band and everything and the loud noise, and then Shah Rukh Khan walks on the stage, or whoever whoever the main performer is, Madonna or whoever. So here now the hero is arriving. That's of course Arjuna and Bhagavan Shri Krishna, our heroes of this particular Mahabharata war and this whole Mahabharata episode. Shvaitair hayer yuktaihi, and their horses were beautiful white. You can see they had beautiful white horses. Some places they have four, some places five. So beautiful shveta hayer yukte. So five horses. Mahati syandane sthitau, and sitting on this beautiful chariot. Now Arjuna's chariot also had been gifted to him by the gods. All his weapons, because he had done so much tapas that the gods themselves came and gave him the chariot. And his chariot had all the latest equipment and all the weapons, and you know, was well accomplished. was a beautiful gold chariot. Hanumanji was sitting on top. You know, what better, you know, person you can have riding your chariot. And beautiful chariot is sthitau, sitting. Sthitau means here sitting two, Madhava and Pandava. Madhava, of course, is Krishna and Pandava is Arjuna. Divyau Shankhau Pradhat Matuhu. So they blew their divine conches. Now, Pradhat, Divyau Shankhau, they are using Dvivachan. In Sanskrit, unlike other languages, most other, all other languages, either we have singular or plural. I and we, you know, one or many. And so the nouns can be either a singular noun or a plural noun. And the verb is either singular or plural depending on the noun. Like he goes and they go. You know, they use it differently. The verbs are different and also the nouns are different. But in Sanskrit, they have ekvachan, dvivachan and bahuvachan. Means there is, if there is one person going, there is one noun. If two people are going, it is separate. The noun is separate, the verb is separate. And if many people are going, then it is separate. So there is ek, do, and then many. So here they are using the two person, because there are two persons. Krishna and Arjuna have arrived sitting on this beautiful chariot, Madhava, Pandava. Now the word Madhava has again a lot of meaning. One is, of course, it is Krishna's name. But the word Madhava has lot of, in Sanskrit, lot of meanings. One is Ma means Mother Lakshmi. So Madhava means Mother Lakshmi's consort, Mother Lakshmi's husband, that is Vishnu, that is Narayan Bhagwan. And Krishna is said to be an incarnation of Vishnu. So he is described as Mother Lakshmi's consort, Mother Lakshmi's husband. That's one meaning. The other meaning, that's at the higher level, at the worldly level, Ma means Maya, Prakriti, this world. And Madhava means who is the Lord of Prakriti, Lord of Maya, Lord of this creation. So that's why they say he is Maya Pati and we are Maya Patita. So means he is the Lord of Maya and we are the slaves or the servants of Maya, because this world is such an illusion. It's so captivating, you know, oh, the world is. So we don't even think of God, we don't think of anything, we get so, what do you call it, bamboozled or fooled by this world. And so that is the difference between us. That's why, you know, there is this bhajan, Tujhme mujhme hai farak yahi, main nar hoon, tum narayan ho, main hoon sansar ke haathon mein, sansar tumhare haathon mein. He says, I am the difference between you and me. I am called Nar and you are called Narayan. Difference is not much. The name is very similar. But I am a slave of the world and the world is under your control. So there's a very beautiful story I had, was thinking about. So there was this boy and his father and they were walking on the street. And they saw this man walking with two policemen, one on each side. So he says, Father, why does he have two policemen, you know, holding him and walking? He said, he's a thief. He stole, and so the two policemen are taking him to jail. Then he saw another man with four policemen, you know, holding him. He said, why is there four policemen with one man? The other, he said, this guy is a greater thief. He's a, you know, dacoit, and he's very dangerous, and he had actually armed robbery and all. So they captured him, and they were afraid that he might escape. So instead of two police, he has four police. So after a while, the son says, Father, I saw the greatest thief of all. He says, where? He said, look there, look there. And there was the king, and he was surrounded by 20 or 30 police. 20 or 30 police, you know. So he must be a greater thief, you know. If the two. So father says, no, no, there is a difference. See, in the first two instances, the police were controlling him. Now here, he controls the police. So that is the difference. You know, so similarly, the world controls us, but he controls the world. That's why he's called Madhava and Pandava, Divya Shankhau Pradhat Matuhu. Now, the word chariot, you know, I had talked about chariot 2-3 weeks back. Would you like me to repeat? That's very, very beautiful about the significance of chariot, that our body is a chariot. Does anybody remember? It's from Kathopanishad. I'll repeat it. It's worth listening to. So the chariot symbolism, here also we can see there is a chariot and there is the Arjuna who is the owner of the chariot, and Krishna is the driver, he is the chauffeur. And the chariot has horses and the chariot has reins by which the horses are controlled, and the horses run on the ground. So that is the how a chariot works. A chariot runs controlled by the charioteer, but the owner is not the charioteer, owner is Arjuna. So similarly, in the Kathopanishad, they say, our body is a chariot. So this body is a chariot. Now, what are the horses? In a horse, chariot has to have horses. So the sense organs are the horses, because the sense organs run in the world. And what is the ground that they run on? Because the horses run on the ground is the sense objects. So the eyes see, the ears hear, the nose smells, the tongue tastes, the skin touches. So the sense objects are the road on which the sense organs of mind, they run on this world. Now what controls the sense? The horses. The horses are controlled by the reins, right? So the mind, the mind is the one that is the reins. So the eyes, so the mind will tell, okay, look at this, don't look at this, see this, don't see this, don't hear this. So the sense organs are controlled by the mind, and so the reins are the ones that control the horses. Now who has the reins in his hand? Here, of course, Lord Krishna, Bhagwan himself. So in our case, it should be the intellect. The intellect, the not only the regular intellect, but the intellect that has been educated by the scriptures. So the intellect which has been learned from the scriptures, the divine intellect should be the charioteer. So the mind should be directed by the intellect. But as we had talked before, sometimes the mind does not listen to the intellect and says, I'll do what I want. That's when we get into trouble. So our divine intellect, which, who has the knowledge of the scriptures from the guru, should be the commander of the intellect and should decide where I should go with this body, this chariot. But if the mind does not listen to the intellect and does what it wants, that's when we got into trouble. Like, I know I'm not supposed to eat this thing and I eat it, or I'm not supposed to do this thing, I do it, or I'm not supposed to say this thing and I say it, then we get into trouble. But the owner of the chariot, Arjuna, is the ego, the perceiver, feeler and thinker, the jiva, the individuality, the I, is the owner of this chariot. So that is the symbolism. Now the Arjuna and Pandava and Krishna, these two, why are they mentioned together? Because Arjuna was the warrior, was doing the action, and Krishna was the divine vision. So when a person does the right action with a divine vision, then success is guaranteed. So for us, when we act in the world, we have to take the Lord and the scriptures with us, and then our actions are pure. If we do what is contrary to the scriptures or what is contrary to the Lord's... So one of the Upanishads, it says, Hari Toshana, what will please my God? What will please? That should be my action. So every time I do this action, is God going to be pleased with me or not? So that should be the basis. That's why Sanjay, the last verse of the Bhagavad Gita, is one of the most famous verse. He says, Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna, Yatra Partho Dhanurdharaha, Tatra Shri Vijayo Bhuti Dhruva Nitir Matir Mama. So Sanjaya says, wherever there is Krishna, the Lord of Yoga, the one with the knowledge, and Partha Dhanurdhara, and Partha with the bow ready to act, there is guaranteed victory, there is guaranteed wealth, there is guaranteed goodness. So goodness can only come when the two are together, Arjuna and Krishna. So Arjuna means me, who is ready to act in the world. Arjuna had a bow and arrow. Our equipment may be different. You know, a doctor has a stethoscope, an engineer has a slide rule, a teacher has her instruction, you know, manual. So different equipments we use, but our action should be guided by Lord. Then and then alone, success is guaranteed, goodness is guaranteed, And so that is the significance of this, of this chariot. And what is the meaning of white? Now he says white horses. So white horses, there are three colors, you know, in the 14th chapter and 17th chapter, Shri Krishna tells us about, talks about sattva, rajas and tamas. Sattva is purity or knowledge, rajas is activity and passion, and tamas is ignorance or sleepiness, inertia. So the sattvic is white. So they say sattvic is white, rajasic is red, you know, passion, and tamas is black. That means inertia, ignorance. So that's why white represents sattvic. So a sattvic, when the sense organs are sattvic, when they are doing the right thing, guided by the mind, guided by the intellect, then the body is led in the right direction and right action happens. So this verse is a very, very beautiful verse. It's not only, see, that's why you might just say, oh, they blew the conch, you know, superficially if you read it. But I've been reading commentaries by different acharyas, Gurudev himself, Swami Bodhatmananda ji and Ishwarananda ji. So each one of them gives something different. So it's good that, you know, we get more out of it. Want to do one more? Panchajanyam Rishikeshah.
Panchajanyam Rishikeshah.
Devadattam Dhananjayah.
Devadattam Dhananjayah.
Paundram Dadmau Mahashankham.
Paundram Dadmau Mahashankham.
Bhimakarma Vrikodarah.
Bhimakarma Vrikodarah.
So Rishikesh was another one of Krishna's names. There are two meanings of that. One is Rishik Isha. Rishik means the sense organs. Isha means the lord of the sense organs. So within us, who controls the sense organs? First the mind. The mind is controlled by the intellect, and then the intellect is controlled by God, by Om. So similarly, the Lord within us is the controller of the senses. So that's why he's called Rishikesha, the controller of the sense organs. Another simpler meaning is Rishikeshaha, because he had this curly hair which were flowing in the wind, and when this chariot used to come with the five horses and the golden chariot and the Lord himself sitting, you know, with his crown and his hair blowing, and then the mighty Arjuna sitting there, it was, you know, a wonderful sight to behold. It must have been for people who could see it. So he was called Rishikesha because his hair used to fly in the wind. He had long hair. This, of course, yeah, here also they show that. So Panchajanyam. So his conch was called Panchajanyam. So each conch had its name and had its peculiarities. Like our computer also, we have, you know, Samsung, like the, you know, the iPhone i8 or the Samsung Galaxy 8. And then each phone has its particular features. You know, your laptop, your computer has all these, you know, it's whatever, 64 gigabyte, megabyte. I'm not very computer smart. But so similarly, all their shanks had their own name and had their specific quality. So Panchajanyam was Krishna's. Devadattam Dhananjaya. And Dhananjaya, he was called Dhananjaya Arjuna. Why? Because one time Yudhishthira, when he was king, he had done a big yagna, and he sent Dhananjaya Arjuna that go to the different kings, and they have a lot of wealth. They are sitting and not using it, you know, just keeping it for themselves. Collect the wealth and use it for the benefit of all. So that's why he was called, because he collected the wealth from these kings who were just storing it and used it. So that's why he got the name Dhananjaya, one who collects wealth. So each one of them blew their conch, Pandram Dadmau Mahashankham, and Bhima was the big, you know, was very mighty. He was very huge. Bhima Karma Vrikodara. He was called Vrikodara. He was called Wolf Belly. Why was he called Wolf Belly? And Bhima Karma, because his actions were big. He was big size, very huge, and he could digest anything. That's why he's called a wolf belly, because a wolf can eat and digest anything. Sometimes they eat the whole animal and digest the whole thing. So Bhima had, that's why even when he was given poison by the Kauravas, he could digest it. He just did exercise and got rid of it. And his Shankha was very huge. Now this Panchajanyam of Krishna has another story. There's actually so many stories associated with everything. So it is said that Krishna, when he went to his guru, his guru's name was Sandipani. And that's why the place where our Swamiji's all study in Mumbai is called Sandipani Sadhanalaya. Sadhanalaya means a place of instruction. And Sandipani, who was Krishna's guru, it's named after him. So Sandipani was Krishna's guru, and Krishna went and learned from him, as they had to do. They had to go to Gurukul, even though he was the lord of the universe and he knew everything, but he had to follow the rules of this world. So he went and studied under his guru. And after his studies were over, you were supposed to give Guru Dakshina. You are supposed to give, you know, a payment or a gift. So he asked the guru and guru's wife, what can I give you? What can I offer you? Now they came with a very strange request. Their son had died a few years back. And so the mother, the guru's wife, says, I want you to bring my son back. I miss my son. I'm crying, even though he died. You know, and she knew he's the Lord. He's God himself. I want you to bring my son back. And so Krishna had to, because once you have taken instruction, whatever the guru's command is, he does. And so Krishna goes and brings the son back, you know, because he was Lord, so he could create him again. And while he was coming back with the son, he was given this shank called Panchajanya by the gods, by the demigods. Another meaning of Panchajanya is there was a demon named Panchajana, who was a very evil demon, and Krishna destroyed him, and as a reward for that, the gods gave him this shank. So that's why there are two different names. And Devadatta was also given to Arjuna by the gods because of his penance. So that's why these shankhas have their specific name and a specific meaning. It's not just random. Any last comments or anything?
You said white color represents
sattva. Right.
How about orange color?
No, those are the three mentioned in the Gita. The white, red, and
No,
the orange for the rishis. Yeah, no, yeah, that is different. That is the color of fire, because that they have burnt all their. Thank you. Yeah, that they have burnt all their attachments, so they have no longer any ties to anybody else. That's orange. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I didn't understand the question. Yeah, that is the sign of sannyasi, yeah, one who has. Us will come later on also.
What about some people wear yellow?
Yellow is when they have not yet become swamis in the Chinmaya mission. First, they start with white. White. When they are students. Then, at the end of 2 years, because white means they are still householders. They have not yet given up their home. They are still connected with their family. Then at the end of the two-year course, or two years and few months, when they decide to take sannyas and give up their family and join the mission full-time, living as brahmacharis, as bachelors, you know, celibates, boys or girls, then they are given the yellow color, signifying that these are brahmacharis. They are celibates, but they are not yet swamis. They are not yet the higher initiated. No, they are initiated, but they are not, yeah, they have not got the full sannyas. So then, after a few years, when they are watched by the head of the mission and by others, and when they are found to be qualified and they have done enough and they know that these people are firm in their brahmacharya, in their sannyas, then they are given their orange clothes and then their hair is shaved and their name is changed. Actually, the name is changed twice. First, from the regular name, they are given the brahmachari name, like Someshwar Chaitanya or Girish Chaitanya, like that. So Chaitanya is given to them. That is the yellow one. And then when they get the orange, then they are called Swami. And then their name is changed again. So they've got three different names. One is their parents' name, and then the brahmachari.
So Chaitanya becomes Swami.
Then. Chaitanya becomes Swami. And the name is also changed.
The name of it.
Yeah, like Prabodh Chaitanya, he became Swami Bodhatmanandaji. So they changed his name. Like Girish Chaitanya became Swami Shiv Priyanandaji, like that. So, and I'm sure they consult them, like, what they would like. Or sometimes the head of the mission does, like Swami Tejomayananda Ji, he gives the name. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramaya, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Makaschit Dukkha Bhagavi. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.